like the economy, and also review his views on the conflict in Ukraine and U.S. double standards on human rights. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Hakime Birin, the Assistant Professor of Islamic Knowledge and Thoughts from the University of Tehran. Also joining us, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, political commentator, both joining us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Hakime Birin, I apologize, I said Birin. Let me first come to you with this question, and I welcome you both. We're looking at the slogan that I'd like to ask from you, since it's very important, obviously, as Iran's leader has stated, production, knowledge-based, and job-creating, and he has stated production to be the center of really the messages behind his economic, I guess, theories as presented in his speech. What is your take on what he has meant by production, knowledge-based, and job-creating?
As you know, Ayatollah Khamenei has been having economics-based slogans for several years now. If I want to put that into context, I should say that it is related to the idea of independence from his perspective, in his viewpoint, and from the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini. What is independence? How is Iran able to achieve independence? In order for Iran to achieve independence, Iran has to go through several stages. The first of which is achieving ideological structure of independence, the idea that, yes, we want to be independent from the system of dominance that is running the world, and that we can do that. So Iran was able to do that through the Islamic Revolution, through the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The second stage is strengthening the system from within, strengthening the country from within. And one of the most difficult aspects of that is the economic aspect, because of the system of dominance that has been running the world for the last 500 years or so, you know, first through a colonial system and then through the dual system of the Cold War and then through the American-centered system of dominance, the world, countries around the world are having a difficult time to be independent economically, which is one of the requirements for them to be able to actually have independence in other aspects and actually be able to prosper in the way that they want, in the way that they see, prosperity and progress, mm-hmm. not in the way that the so-called global powers want them to see it. So in order for Iran to be strong from within, we need to focus on the economy. And one of the best ways to achieve economic strength is through knowledge-based approach to economics and to running the economy of the country. So okay. I think this is what the significance of this slogan is, that there's no other way that Iran can achieve real independence other than it can have a strong economy from within.
Sure. The independence part of your statements there is also contributing to a lot of other ripple effects in the economy based on that, which we will hopefully get into a little later on. Say, Mostafa Khoshesh, you know, from the outside looking in, people are going to wonder, what does knowledge-based economy mean? Because Iran's leader has said to move forward with this knowledge-based economy, an economic system where knowledge plays an vital role in all fields of production is how he addressed it. But the knowledge-based economy phrase, if you can explain to us what that means, at least for us to get a better idea here.
Hello, and thanks for having me. As Professor Birria said, this is a very important point that was touched by the leader in this year's message, as well as messages in the past few years. It's part of independence of Iran and growing into a regional and world power. You need to develop your hard power, as well as your semi-hard and soft power. Since Iran had the revolution back in 1979, it was under much pressure by foreign threats from the imposed war by former dictator Saddam Hussein to sanctions, as well as attempts for staging coup d'etats. Iran has been under much threat by, hard power, military power, political power, by enemies. Therefore, in reaction, it has developed its power in this specific area. So it has a very robust military power, not only in the region, but also it's one of the best now, of course, globally speaking. It has a very effective and robust missile power, drone power. But now the threat of enemy, especially the United States, has changed in nature. For the past one or two decades, they've been using their economic power to undermine Iran and its power. And they've also been using soft power to undermine the Islamic Republic of Iran. So you need to develop the same kind of power that, the kind of experience that we had in the past two decades in economic areas as well as in soft areas. Now, Iran has, developed a very effective, Iran has effectively grown its, different sciences, branches of science, like in nanotechnology, in stem cell technology, in aerospace technology, satellite technology, and in nuclear technology. As far as knowledge and science and technology is concerned, Well, Iran is one of the pioneering powers in all these areas, but when it should be interpreted into business, into economic benefit and interest, there is a missed, there is a gap and the chain and the ring is lost in there. Iran is very much powerful in area of nanotechnology, but when it comes to making benefit and becoming, economically speaking, a global power in this specific branch or in area of satellite industries or satellite launch industries or in many other areas like stem cell technology, then you see that Iran is not using this kind of branch of science for becoming a global economic power. This is the chain. There's a chain and this part is missed. So this is a very important problem that we need to, solve. And the Iranian leader was tasked with, larger scale and strategic planning for the country based on the constitution. He is now drawing attention that in future, from now on, when we are talking about economy, we should not just talk about consumption. We should not talk about farming or industries generally. We need to have a well-detailed plan based on those areas that we are pioneering in science and technology. And we can become one of the global powers in these areas, including nanotechnology, stem cell technology, and so on and so forth. Sure. So he's speaking of strategic planning for the country to become globally semi-hard you know, powerful country, or more specifically, an economic power in the region and the world in coming decades. And he's drawing a plan to do that based on those sciences and technologies that we've been able to make major breakthroughs.
Sure. And I'd like to just add something to it in terms of an observation from me, since I am not an economist, nor am I even familiar with this, but based on the insight you've given us, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, my overall perception is that there needs to be, in whatever sector that Iran wants to make advancements, that it needs to be up-to-date technologically in order for the question which I'm going to ask our guest, Hakim Abiria, in order to focus on, for example, the production aspect of the statement and the slogan from Iran's leader. And Ms. Hakim Abiria, you talked about independence. Independence is something that Iran can pride itself because it's been under sanctions for so many decades, really. And based on what Iran's leader has said, boosting domestic production is the sole way to achieve equitable progress in the economy. And he cited how that can overcome the problem of poverty in the country. So independence brings about domestic production, no matter what field it is. Can you give us the relationship there of the independence which you talked about before and how Iran's leader has focused on this boosting of the domestic production?
Of course, the idea is that when Iran went out of, brought itself out of that system of, client patron relationship with the United States, it was bombarded with a multi-layer hybrid system of pressure, which included an economic aspect. So Iran was not left on its own to prosper during the years after the revolution. So it has to have a special, policies in order to be robust internally, be strong internally, and be able to withstand all that pressure that is coming from the outside world, especially from the United States. The leader actually pointed out the fact that we have been under unprecedented pressure economically during the past decade. That idea, the phrase that has been used during the Trump administration and the policy that has been kept during the Biden administration, all the pressures that have been brought upon the Islamic Republic, it requires for us, in order to be able to prosper internally, to have a very specific focus on the health of the economy, on the policies that are taken in order to achieve the economic goals of the Islamic Revolution. And let me bring up another key word that was missed so far from the speech, today's speech. The leader pointed out that we are after an economy that is based on justice, something that has been missing in the world for the past couple of hundred years, because the systems that have been running the world, either communism or capitalism for that matter, both have missed having justice as a goal. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as an economy that is based on justice. So the Islamic Republic is after something that is new to the world. Uh-huh. So in order for us to be able to achieve that sort of independence, that we want to have an economy that is based on justice, we need to take very, specific measures that, this year the slogan has been a knowledge-based sure. economy that is going to be able to create jobs as well.
Okay, you need to break that open for us, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, and how that could relate to another core message or statement that Iran's leader made, and that is that the country's economy should not be tied to U.S. sanctions, where at the same time, simultaneously, he's also practically saying that it doesn't mean that we have to not strive for eliminating the sanctions, but we have to make sure that that's not tied to Iran's economy. Tell us how that can be done and the challenges that may be there and how Iran may overcome it. Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh? Okay, it doesn't seem like we have him. Ms. Hakimi Birria, that is one of the things that Iran's leader talked about. He was actually very pleased. He said one of the sweet moments of this past year was what you were talking about, how the U.S. admitted that its maximum pressure campaign had failed. So how can the country's economy not be tied to U.S. sanctions?
Bring up this idea that the United States is using sanctions as a pressure technique, and then at the same time is using negotiations as another pressure technique. So we are not seeing an either or scenario where we have pressure and then we have lifting of pressure. So the negotiations are there, but then all along during Republican presidencies and during the Democratic presidencies, we have heard from the U.S. Policymakers and from U.S. Government officials that the sanctions are going to be there, no matter what the results of the negotiations. In one way or another, even during the JCPOA, the United States did not lift primary sanctions. So Iran was still under sanctions even when the JCPOA was in effect. And that was how the United States kept Iran from benefiting from any of those things that were there in JCPOA that were in the interests of Iran. So we have to realize this, and we have to be able to live with this reality. And the only way that we can do that is by becoming strong and by becoming independent from the system that is trying to keep the pressure on, no matter what.
Very well. Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, let's change the whole landscape of our conversation to another very different topic, and that is the statements made on the Ukraine conflict by Iran's leader. He said how he was surprised and how it revealed, not surprised, he said it revealed what he called blatant racism that he said was rampant in the West. And he pinpointed to how Western countries had this double standards in dealing with white and black refugees in reference to, I guess, the one particular incident where African students said they were facing racism on trains and on buses while trying to flee Ukraine. It was interesting that that is something that stood out for him in order to relay that to us during his speech.
For decades, critics of the United States and the Western hegemonic rule and civilization would say that the U.S. and the West is very much hypocritical when it comes to its so-called Western values, like democracy, human rights, and legitimacy, and then there were people who were not convinced, apparently, and they were saying that this is not the case. But ever since the Khashoggi case, this hypocrisy, this exercise of double standards has become very much evident. Even Americanophiles would never defend the Western, the West in this regard. After Donald Trump and Biden both ignored the butchery that happened at the Saudi consulate in Turkey, in Istanbul, in the case of Khashoggi. And they both said that economy and business matters more than, the case. We've been witnessing an increasing number of events throughout the world, with Ukraine being one of the latest ones, that have all unveiled how hypocritical the West is. When they check not only for the color of skin, but also they say it out loud in the media that there is a difference between the Middle Eastern nations, the black or brown or yellow-colored people, and mm-hmm. the white and the blue and green eyed people, they say it. They are not even shy of acknowledging and speaking about it. They always say in the media in the past month, ever since the Ukraine war started and there have been refugees, sure. I've been talking about it increasingly and saying that you should never, the media, the intellectuals, as well as journalists and thinkers of the West, they okay. address the Western nations and saying that you should not be indifferent because they are not Arabs, they are not Muslims, they are not, strangers. They are us, the okay. white people, the green, blue-eyed people. So this is a very important notion because the Ukraine war, I believe, has exposed the very deeply rooted understanding right. and paranoia of the West with regard to the others. The okay. others could be Muslims, Iranians, or even East Asian nations,
sure.
or the black people. They are the others, and they just okay. love and adore and want respect for their own people and nation. And that's a very, profound problem with the Western understanding of humanity.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. I wanted to squeeze in one more question, but we can't. But it was a pleasure, Ms. Hakima Birya, Assistant Professor of Islamic Knowledge and Thoughts from the University of Tehran. Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh, thank you so much for your input, political commentator, both from Tehran. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahvayi, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وعادا وثمود وأصحاب الرس وقرونا بين ذلك كثيرا.
And we destroyed Ad and Thamud and the companions of the well and many generations between them.
وَكُلًّا ضَرَبْنَا لَهُ الْأَمْثَالِ وَكُلًّا تَبَّرْنَا تَتْبِيرًا.
And for each we presented examples as warnings, and each we destroyed with total destruction.
As you have been previously with us, brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 38th and 39th verses of the chapter. وَعَادًا وَثَمُودَ وَأَصْحَابَ الرَّسِّ وَقُرُونًا بَيْنَ ذَلِكَ كَثِيرًا. And the tribes of Ad and Thamud, and the men of Ar-Ras, and many generations between them. وَكُلًّا ضَرَبْنَا لَهُ الْأَمْثَالِ. And unto each of them we did give examples. وَكُلًّا تَبَّرْنَا تَتْبِيرًا. And every one of them we did destroy with utter extermination. Previously, we said that this section of this chapter, Furqan, is talking to what happens to the disbeliever people in the previous nations. It started with the story of Prophet Moses, his brother Aaron, that were supposed to go to Pharaoh. Then, the story of Prophet Noah was mentioned, that the Almighty Allah had made them a sign for all mankind, because they had rejected the messengers. And now, the story of Ad, Thamud, and Ashab al-Ras is being discussed. Although, the verse does not suggest the detailed story of what happened to each of these people, but in the 39th verse it says, وَكُلًّا ضَرَبْنَا لَهُ الْأَمْثَالِ. Unto each of them we did give examples. So, it has been the tradition and sunnah of the Almighty Allah to send the prophets for the guidance of the people, and it has been the Almighty Allah's sunnah to destroy the ones who used to deny these prophets and the signs of the Almighty Allah. كَذَّبُوا الرُّسُلْ فَأَغْرَقْنَاهُمْ. They denied the messengers, so we drowned them. And then وَعَادًا وَثَمُودَ.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أَنْتُمُ الْفُقَرَاءُ
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So the people of Ad and people of Thamud were also destroyed because they used to deny their messengers. And then it says, وَكُلَّنْ ضَرَبْنَا لَهُ الْأَمْثَالِ. The Almighty Allah has made and given example for all the people throughout the history of universe. Unto each of them we did give examples. وَكُلَّنْ تَبَّرْنَا تَتْبِيرًا. And every one of them we did destroy with utter extermination. So, at first, we gave them warning, we gave them examples, we told them to think about what happened to the previous people before them who used to deny them messengers. And when they did not pay attention, when they did not take lessons from that, we destroyed them because they also rejected the messengers. So this verse is implying that the Almighty Allah did not punish these people astonishingly. It says, كُلَّنْ ضَرَبْنَا لَهُ الْأَمْثَالِ. The Almighty Allah says, unto each of them we did give examples. It means that Almighty Allah answered the pretext of these wrongdoers, disbelievers. He answered their criticism, as was done about the criticisms upon the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Allah made divine ordinances clear for them. Allah explained the truths of religion. Allah warned them and He retold them the stories and destiny of the former nations. And more importantly, why these people, the previous nations, were destroyed. Why were they subjected to the wrath of the Almighty Allah and they were doomed to utter extermination? But when none of these was effective, the status was, as the verse says, وَكُلَّنْ تَبَّرْنَا تَتْبِيرًا. And every one of them we did destroy with utter extermination. We told you that the word تَتْبِير means to lose dignity and respect and to get overthrown in a way that will lead to utter destruction and humiliation. So, yes, the divine way of treatment is to send messengers for guiding people and then to destroy their rejectors. And this is what has happened to the previous nations who did not listen to their own prophets and messengers. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, when faith begins.
Happy Iranian New Year! Happy Nowruz! In lockstep with spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at Arabi English Radio wish you happiness and prosperity.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity marking the first day of spring and the renewal of nature. Nowruz, a legacy from thousands of years ago, always energizes people celebrating the event to observe many customs.
Nowruz promotes values of peace and solidarity within families and across generations. It is believed to be a key contributor to cultural diversity and friendship among different communities.
Days before the arrival of Nowruz, Iranians hastily do backlogs and go shopping to embrace the turn of the Persian year, with a lot of ceremonial customs waiting to be observed. Iranians get prepared for Nowruz by cleaning their house, a custom known as Khana Tekani. Dusting and cleaning home appliances and furniture, washing rugs and etc. are just parts of the house cleaning process. Moreover, the Nowruz festivity has a symbolic item unique to this tradition, Sofreye Haftsin. The Haftsin spread includes seven items, all starting with the letter Sin in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there is a history behind each element, including Serke, or vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality. Somek is a symbol of love and compassion. Sib, or apple, is said to represent health and fertility. Senjad, or silver berry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection. Sabze, or sprout, symbolizes rebirth. Sir, or garlic, is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction. And Samanu represents affluence.
Iranians spend the night of Nowruz with their family. The traditional New Year dinner is fish with rice and herbs. Many families give a money gift called AD to the children to mark the New Year. People often visit each other's homes and always bring traditional gifts.
Nowruz provides a good opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz has been regarded as the feast of unification. The celebration of Nowruz needs a happy ending to make it perfect. So on the last day of this celebration, people go outdoors to celebrate the end of the Nowruz holidays. The last day of Nowruz holidays is called Sizdabedar, or 13-day out, which is also called Nature's Day.
Nowruz is a time for family and friends to gather and celebrate the end of one year and the beginning of the next. Preparing for Nowruz starts a few weeks before the new year with the traditional spring cleaning of the home. At this time, it is also customary to purchase new clothing and new furniture for the home.
In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz as an international event at the initiative of several countries that share this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. It is now widely known to be a symbol of peace to many people.
Nowruz is reminiscent of renewal and a new life. It's something beyond a mere festival. It's a culture which introduces a human civilization. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Refugees are welcome here. The most popular chant at today's protest. Thousands gathered outside the BBC over the weekend, disappointed yet again by the way Western governments are treating people fleeing war and persecution.
People here today say that the British population is being brainwashed by a racist state-funded media. That's probably why today's protest is being held outside the BBC. They want to know why Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed, but refugees from almost anywhere else will soon be branded criminals.
The UK has issued 4,000 visas for Ukrainians with family in Britain, and anyone with a spare room is being offered £350 a month to house those without family here. They can stay for 3 years, they can work, and will have access to public services, including the National Health Service. Meanwhile, the government is pushing through the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill that could see refugees from elsewhere arriving via routes like the English Channel get up to 4 years in prison.
I feel like we're forgetting that other people are still fighting to be like considered as worthy of empathy, and we need to keep thinking about people in Palestine, in Yemen, And, you know, all the previous refugees that came to the UK, for instance, that were not treated as well, like the Syrian refugees. And for me, I think this is what today is about, to remember that we're all humans and we all deserve to be treated the same way.
Protests like these attract people campaigning for various causes, all of them somehow related to the persecution of minorities and racism.
I've been a supporter of Stand Up to Racism for many years. I grew up in apartheid South Africa and left the country because of the apartheid situation and came to England and did my education here. And I am very sympathetic to refugees. I'm appalled that we don't have, as a formerly Christian country in this country, a more open and welcoming view on refugees.
We are not against anti-Semitism. We are against the violent action of being to our kids in Gaza. And we are totally supporting Jewish people, and we are totally supporting anyone who is decent to others and peaceful to others.
Before hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees mobilized, the UK insisted its public services are at breaking point. Tabloid newspapers encouraged millions to vote for Brexit in 2016, creating the illusion that Britain was being overrun by foreigners. But the media is now sending a very different message. It seems the NHS can cope, and Ukrainian refugees will not be taking any British jobs. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States and its key ally, the UK, launched the Iraq War in 2003 with a strike against a location where then-Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and his top commanders were believed to be meeting. But that was not an abrupt attack, as Washington and London had already begun intensifying their military build-ups in the Persian Gulf beforehand. U.S. President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair repeatedly indicated that the assault was imminent and aimed to destroy Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program. But neither UN inspectors nor intelligence services could ever find such weapons in Iraq.
None of those pretexts were really help us explain the overall project that the U.S. had in this region.
Ironically, Washington and London gave little heed to calls to allow the inspections process be given more time. Saddam, a once ally who had the full support of the U.S. and Western countries during his eight-year war against Iran, had finally grown too defiant for the U.S. to tolerate. The Iraq War, estimated to have cost the U.S. nearly $5.5 trillion and over 4,500 deaths among its servicemen. For Iraqis, the cost was much higher. More than 1 million people were killed and millions displaced, while millions more continue to face insecurity and poverty. Birth defects and cancer rates also sharply increased, as foreign forces used depleted uranium weapons in civilian areas. 19 years on since the U.S.-led invasion, the war agents are yet to be charged for any of their crimes.
War on Iraq was one of eight wars in West Asia and North Africa, which the U.S. was carrying out in service of its plans to create a so-called New Middle East, where the entire region would be under the tutelage of the U.S. and its key allies, Israel and the Saudis.
The U.S. announced ending its combat mission in 2011, but 3 years later it started boosting deployment again, this time under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Throughout recent years, there have been multiple reports of Washington's nexus with the Takfiri terrorists, while Iraqis, with the help of the regional resistance front, were fighting themselves to eliminate Daesh.
It's now official. Russia's English-language state broadcaster, RT, stripped of its broadcasting license in the UK.
The decision was made by media regulator Ofcom that said it does not consider RT, with studios in the building behind me, fit and proper to hold a UK license, and that it cannot be satisfied that RT can be a responsible broadcaster.
To some, the move that followed weeks of rising tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine crisis was long overdue. To others, censorship, pure and simple. Journalist Afshin Ratansi is the host of the broadcaster's flagship program, Going Underground.
We've been in this situation together when they banned Press TV, Iran's program. I worked for Press TV. They banned that. They banned CGTN, the Chinese television company. Now they're banning RT. It just shows how much Britain is on the wrong side of history. It is the end of press freedom, the end completely, to me, it seems, like of informed consent, as in democracy. You can't have democracy without informed consent, and the British people can no longer watch programs that dissent from the prevailing narrative fed to us by the BBC and others.
The decision has also called into question Ofcom's independence. RT Deputy Editor-in-Chief Anna Belkina accused the regulator of being nothing more than a tool of the government.
I don't like censorship of any kind. I very much believe in freedom of speech. With freedom of speech comes responsibility, which is why we have Ofcom as a regulator. But if Ofcom is going to become an extension of the government, peddling out that particular government style of propaganda, we are indeed entering into very dangerous territory.
As RTE falls victim to unmitigated hostility towards Russia over Ukraine, media consumers here in the UK lose an important source that's brought them the other side of so many stories for so many years. Saeed Puriza, London.
The outrage was palpable at today's protest. A Freedom of Information request revealed this week that racism was a factor in the Metropolitan Police's horrific strip search of a schoolgirl known as Child Q in 2020. She was forced to bend over for two female police officers to look at her private parts. No other trusted adult was present and her parents weren't informed. The Met officers are now under investigation. Some assert that the strip search of Child Q was an isolated incident, a crime perpetrated by a few bad apples. But members of the community disagree.
I think this feels a systematic approach that the police use. They may now regret using it in this particular instance. They may say that. How people could conceptualise strip searching a girl in school without her mum knowing about it, without an adult present, it's just heartbreaking.
Child Q has launched legal proceedings against the Metropolitan Police and her school. Many prominent figures have offered their support. The school called the police on Child Q, saying she smelt of marijuana. The strip search yielded no evidence of her being in possession of drugs.
They're out here in the streets, in our schools, to defend their interests. They're out here to discipline us, to create and sow and violently enforce the divisions that the ruling class needs in order to rule us and oppress us.
Now black families are torn on how to safeguard their children, to make them aware of the dangers without terrifying them of going to school.
I had to take my children out of a previous school because the black children are being treated different than the white children in schools in London, in England. And that needs to stop. I have girls a similar age to this woman, to this young woman that it's happened to, and I'm so emotional about it that I can't even speak about it.
I used to work with children in homes, looked after children, and sometimes the children would complain that they were abused in the station. They ain't got no trust for the police, they ain't got no trust for society, for social care, they ain't got no trust anymore.
Horrified but not surprised, that was the reaction of many here today. In the past 5 years, more than 172,000 strip searches have been conducted in London, and the statistics show black people are three times more likely to be targeted. There were mothers, aunties and educators at today's protest, vowing to protect their youth. But with police being called into schools and parents alerted after the fact, how can they? Bianca Rahimi, London.
From Kurdish horses to Kurdish music and dance, this festival is all about showcasing the traditions of Iran's province of Kurdistan in celebrating the Persian New Year known as Nowruz.
I wish you a happy Nowruz. I hope that the new year will be treating you well and the COVID pandemic will be over.
I welcome all of my fellow Iranian citizens who have come to visit Sanandaj. I wish them health and wealth in the new year.
The ceremony also saw Iranians coming from other provinces, both to get acquainted with the Kurdish culture and to showcase their own customs in celebrating Nowruz.
We've come from Sistan and Baluchistan province. I'm so glad to see all Iranian ethnicities have happily gathered here to celebrate Nowruz.
I congratulate you on Nowruz. I'm from Khorasan province, and today I watched the Kurdish dance, and it was amazing.
Nowruz marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, which falls on March 21st. The ancient tradition is celebrated by some 300 million people in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other countries. That's why this event has also hosted activists from other countries.
I congratulate the arrival of Nowruz to all nations that celebrate this occasion. We in Tajikistan also mark Nowruz magnificently, as it's a time for peace and friendship. I thank the UNESCO for organizing this event.
There is so much beauty in the way Iranians celebrate Nowruz. Each city has different traditions in marking Nowruz, and that is exciting. We in Afghanistan do share some of the traditions here.
Unlike Iran, in Afghanistan we don't have the haft-seen spread, but we do have haft-miveh, which is a spread with seven different fruits prepared on the turn of the year. I think we're here to celebrate these differences as they make Nowruz a diverse festivity.
Initiated by the UNESCO's Tehran office, the ceremony came as part of the caravan of Nowruz, which set out from the city of Hamadan, stopped in Kermanshah, and wrapped up in Kurdistan, bringing together representatives from each Iranian province to showcase their Nowruz traditions.
Their return to British soil, like their period of incarceration, a media event of the highest order. British Iranians Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe and Anousheh Shouri touched down at Bryce Norton Air Base in the early hours of Thursday morning. Both had been jailed on espionage charges in Iran. Their release comes after months of delicate negotiations and culminated in their freedom, according to a statement from Iran's foreign ministry, on the basis of Islamic leniency and humanitarian considerations. In what has become a media firestorm, much has been made of Britain's repayment of a historic debt to the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic has consistently rejected any links between London's repayment of a decades-old debt and the release of the British Iranian nationals, despite attempts in Western mainstream media reporting to conflate the two issues.
We received the money a few days ago, but simultaneously the judicial process for the release of these two persons was going on. Maybe chronologically, their release and the deposit of the money were close, but there is no connection between these two issues.
UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss had previously spoken of making the repayment of Iranian debt a priority.
I've also been very clear that the debt that we owe Iran is legitimate, and we are seeking ways to pay that.
The release of the two dual nationals is the culmination of years of talks between London and Tehran, including a political revelation by then Foreign Secretary, now MP Boris Johnson, that Zaghari Ratcliffe was not a charity worker, as was widely stated.
He admitted, didn't he, at the dispatch box that she was employed by Reuters in training journalists. And as I've said, that is a classic tactic that's used to, you know, develop assets in nations that you know, Britain has hostilities towards. So, you know, in that sense, I think, you know, he let the cat out of the bag. And obviously we know now that, you know, an agreement's been reached and she's been released. But, I mean, I think that did reveal that there was a lot more to this situation than we were being told by the corporate media in this country.
Both Zaghari Ratcliffe and her employer, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, had maintained she was simply visiting family while on vacation. A third person, Murat Abbas, has also been released but remains in Iran for the time being.
Amina Taylor, London.
There is consensus at the highest political and military levels in the West that closing Ukraine's airspace to Russia would likely trigger World War III and potentially result in a catastrophic nuclear war. Despite this, many EU legislators suggest it's time for NATO to become directly involved in the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
Unfortunately, our good friends from Washington, they were too afraid. They were afraid that they are triggering the war, but I can't imagine where we're gonna trigger the war. Europe is in the war already.
But a debate on the subject in the European Parliament on Thursday heard calls for peace rather than further intervention.
I don't think this war can be won militarily from one side, and therefore it is essential that we do all we can to ensure there is a ceasefire.
According to some experts, the conflict will become protracted as both sides are very unlikely to back down.
Ukraine is not going to give these things to Russia. I mean, President Zelensky has talked about this neutrality issue. That's one thing. But when it comes to actual territory and the other things that Russia is asking for, I mean, this is just non-negotiable.
Via video link, the Ukrainian Defence Minister, Alexei Reznikov, told MEPs that more than 3 million people have fled his country so far. Many nations have simplified visa regimes in order to assist, he explained.
Unlike other countries like Israel, for example, that actually made it more difficult for our refugees to unite with their families in Israel, I was very surprised by that.
During this debate, the governments of Spain, Bulgaria and Turkey were heavily criticised for not fully backing the West's anti-Russia agenda. In recent debates here, lawmakers who support Russia have been demonised. At present, it appears, any form of balance on this subject is unacceptable to most. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
When called upon to believe that Barack Obama was really born in Kenya, millions got in line. When encouraged to believe that the 2012 Sandy Hook murder of 20 children and 6 adults was a hoax, too many stepped up. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by Rebecca Solnit, the author of Orwell's Roses. The article has been published in the New York Times opinion section. It is titled Why Republicans Keep Falling for Trump's Lies. When called upon to believe that Barack Obama was really born in Kenya, millions got in line. When encouraged to believe that the 2012 Sandy Hook murder of 20 children and 6 adults was a hoax, too many stepped up. When urged to believe that Hillary Clinton was trafficking children in the basement of a Washington, D.C. pizza parlor with no basement, they bought it. And one of them showed up in the pizza place with a rifle to protect the kids. The fictions fed the frenzies, and the frenzies shaped the crises of 2020 and 2021. The delusions are legion. Secret democratic cabals of child abusers, millions of undocumented voters, falsehoods about the COVID-19 pandemic and the vaccine. While much has been said about the moral and political stance of people who support right-wing conspiracy theories, their gullibility is itself alarming. Gullibility means malleability and manipulability. We don't know if the people who believed the prevailing 2012 conspiracy theories believed the 2016 or 2020 versions, but we do know that a swathe of the conservative population is available for the next delusion and the one after that. And on 6th of January 2021, we saw that a lot of them were willing to act on those beliefs. The adjective gullible comes from the verb to gull, which used to mean to cram yourself with something, as well as to cheat or dupe. to cram someone else full of fictions. Not doubting I could gull the government, wrote Daniel Defoe in 1701.